Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
The Inequality in Australia Report 2018 by the University of New South Wales in conjunction with ACOS, the Australian Council of Social Services, was released a few days ago. The report highlights the stark disparities between the haves and the have-nots in Australia and the impact that it may have on society, indeed, unless we address those inequalities with public policy. Beyond the personal effects on individuals, vast disparities in income can indeed erode social cohesion. It can undermine economic growth, according to the researchers. The report found that the top 1% of income earners receive more income in a fortnight than the lowest 5% earn in a year. And beyond those extremities, because it's often difficult arguing at the margins, isn't it? In the middle, there is also this growing issue about generational wealth. ACOS Chief Executive Officer Dr. Cassandra Goldie says the report underscores Australia's position amongst the most unequally wealthy nations in the world. That seems funny for a nation that's always prided itself on its egalitarianism. Cassandra Goldie, welcome back to Open House.
Yes, good evening.
The real value of statistics like this is to see movement over time. So what's the story being told of movement over time?
First of all, on the income front, what we certainly saw was a big growth in income inequality leading up to the global financial crisis. Now, that was government policies, and of course we had a lot of growth in investment income for people who had a lot, you know, wealth behind them. But post the GFC, it hasn't grown more, but we're still above average when it comes to the OECD in terms of income wealth. So top 20% now earning five times people in the bottom 20% of the community. And if you're in that top 1%, on average, you're earning $11,600 per week, in contrast to people in the bottom 5% of the community, which is just $436 per week.
Yeah.
So there's a big disparity there.
Yeah.
And I think that the community can see that. We know, I mean, Credit Suisse has confirmed this. We've got really a high number of people described as ultra-wealthy, Stephen, about 3,000 of us, who are earning over $50 million US dollars.
Speak for yourself there.
I'm trying to be inclusive. You never know.
The royal
one
we.
Of those people might be listening to us this evening. But you
look,
know,
they might be. And I'm going to say this. I'm going to say something here that might be a little counterintuitive to you. Some of those people are exceedingly generous. We've
Absolutely.
Seen, for example, Andrew Forrest and his wife. They're pledged to give away their wealth. So, you know, I think sometimes we can fall into the danger of just unfairly characterising individuals. And it, in a sense, for me, yes, it's important to know about the 1% and think about that, and many of them can be challenged to do more, I'm sure. But it's not only about the 1%, is it? It's really about the bulk of people in the middle.
It is.
And as I read this report, as you say, Australia is pretty high up on the OECD list of unequal countries
yeah.
in terms of income.
Yeah.
But what I'm seeing here is, and I'd love you to comment on it, is this generational effect that largely
yes.
Is driven by property ownership.
Mm. Well, that is the biggest story in this. When we look at the wealth inequality, so how much you've saved, how much you've got behind you, we've got a big divide continuing to grow even after the global financial crisis. So, and for the first time, the highest average wealth now is being owned by people who are over 64 years of age, and that's grown by 57% since the 2003 period, you know, so 15 years, gone up by 57%, that age group. For under 35s, it's much slower, less than half the growth during that period, and definitely, you know, much less. So it's not a good picture. And look, this is one of those times, I think this point you made earlier about, you know, are we judging people? No, we're not saying you're a bad person because you're in the top 1% or you're over 64 years of age. It's about us understanding what's happening in our community as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah, because it can drive policy and helping to set policy. That's exactly right.
That's it.
Yep.
That's right. So, and many older people are the first to be really worried about young people now.
Well, yes, because they're their children and they're their grandchildren. You just look at the circumstances of your life and, you know, some of us had a huge uplift when property prices suddenly took off. Well, it was nothing special that we did. We were just there, squatting, as it were. But nevertheless, you know, then people say, well, I've got to provide for my retirement. It's very complex to manage a society for equality. But what are some of the things ACOS would love to see then?
Well, so, I mean, this growth in the value of property is obviously one of the big drivers of that disparity in terms of, you know, wealth. So if you were able to purchase a property, particularly during that boom era, you know, pre-GFC, it just skyrocketed and you've done very well. But what's also fueled it is there were generous tax rules introduced, particularly during the Howard government era, actually, the discount on capital gains tax, which helped to fuel property investors getting into the property market, buying up housing at the expense, frankly, of, you know, people who are trying to get their first or, you know, for home or buy back in. You know, you have a divorce or something and you're trying to get back in. So we definitely, we still believe it's very important to fix the distortions in the treatment of tax and property. Property is there, yes, it's there, you know, as an investment, but most importantly for all of us, it's got to be about making sure we can all get housing and a home. So dealing with negative gearing, we believe, is important, that changing the discount on the capital gains for investment properties to stop sort of encouraging people to sell, to try and get a tax break on your capital gain, very important. And, of course, lifting up the incomes of the bottom 40% of the community. Now, you might remember infamously, really, the former Treasurer, Mr. Hockey, made that comment. Remember housing affordability, get a better job? Remember that?
Oh, yeah, I think he regrets it.
Well, of course he did regret it because it kind of felt pretty, you know, touch. It felt out of touch, right? It just, well, it's not that easy. And, of course, then we had, I think it was, you know, the Prime Minister, you know, suggesting, well, you know, help your kids out to buy their property. Well, okay, if you've got something, but many parents, of course, aren't in the position to do that. So incomes matter. Of course incomes matter. We've got to lift up the incomes of people on the bottom 40% of the community. That's why we continue to push for the increase to Social Security payments, that New Start allowance, to at least enable you to rent with a level of dignity. To have a go at getting some rental property and then, of course, to lift up the wage rates. And that's the wage stagnation continues to be something that it's a complex set of factors.
Well, it is. And clearly, the Reserve Bank has got its mind on that problem because with low interest rates and, in fact, property prices coming down, with low interest rates and low wage growth, you've got a stagnation potential in the economy. But I wonder, in that context then, it's hard to know which way to jump for some people, I imagine, maybe some of us, on the question of the corporate tax cuts. Because you can argue that it's about productivity and maybe even lifting wages if our businesses can become more competitive by taxes, by a better tax regime here, which might just allow them to compete against countries in other areas where wages are lower.
Well, you know, look, this is an argument, of course, that's been run extensively by the federal government and, of course, representatives from the business community that would benefit from the cut to the corporate tax rate at the higher end. We strongly oppose it, Stephen. I mean, it's not to say you wouldn't consider it at a point in time if all the settings were right, but bang for your buck, if you're looking for what to do to lift up economic growth in Australia, it is actually more important to lift up the incomes of the bottom 40% of the population. That analysis has been done by both the OECD and the IMF, which says an inclusive growth strategy is what's needed.
Well, Cassandra,
of course,
that's
about people having the ability to spend and to spend, have some discretionary spending in the economy.
No contest. Absolutely no contest.
Yep.
I'm genuinely interested to know how ACOS believes you can increase wages. Mm. How can you do that? Greater productivity? I mean, there's got to be a trade-off somewhere.
Well, this is partly tied to the flaw that we create around Social Security. I mean, part of the problem we've got is that Social Security, the unemployment payment, has fallen so far behind the minimum wage that there is actually, ironically, a downward pressure on those base rates of pay because Newstart is so unbearably low. Yeah. So there is not the same kind of bargaining power is not there in the way that it has been in the past.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Of course, the role of unions in Australian society is important. We should be ensuring that that unions can do their job collectively. I think we have to understand the psychology of what's happened for people in the community post the global financial crisis. I mean, people saw the devastation of mass job losses, certainly in the US and in other countries. You know, we all watched it happening. And there was this real fear that kind of came through the community that, gee, if you didn't lose your job, you were very lucky to have one.
Yeah.
And you were very lucky to have one that felt secure.
Yeah.
And so there is, I think, and many, you know, this is the ongoing analysis we're all doing, that there is this behavioural problem at the moment that people are not feeling confident to push for higher wages.
That's interesting.
Because they're worried of this sort of latent fear that, gee, you know, I should be lucky about where I am. Well,
that is interesting. I wonder what other people think.
Yeah, I think I actually think some of the economists have not grappled with this in the way that, you know, like they keep saying to us, well, it just doesn't stack up. Like, we listen to people in the community, you know, the people who can't get enough paid work, the level of insecure work, underemployment, and there's a dynamic there that for people who do have secure ongoing work, you kind of feel like you should be lucky rather than going, well, hang on a minute, I'm actually not getting paid enough.
Yeah, yes, I can see how that would work. Cassandra Goldie is with us. She's the head of ACOS, the Australian Council of Social Services, and the release of this report in conjunction with the University of New South Wales on Australia's wealth inequality. I want to, just before you go, I'd like to ask you about the My Health Record issue. Mm. ACOS, of course, is raising great concerns about privacy, and everybody is.
Yes.
Is it ACOS's view that this, nevertheless, is an improvement, that this is a reform that's necessary?
It's a system that we should be trying to build and build well.
Yeah.
Electronic records keeping is with us, and we should, you know, if you look from a public health point of view and from a medical treatment point of view, there are lots of benefits for being able to make this kind of data easily accessible.
Yeah, we can't just shut our minds to the use of technology forever. Yes, you've got to be careful about it. So.
Very, very careful. And I think what's happened is that I think the agency has clearly stated that it has not released people's data to third parties without, you know, court orders or warrants in the past.
Yes.
That's been its policy position, and we accept that the original legislation didn't provide the protections in law. It was only policy. And so we have welcomed that the minister has now said he's going to fix that and urgently get that legislation amended. But I think it was definitely a positive that the minister has said, yes, he accepts there's a problem. Because you have to build confidence. You have to be confident.
Well, you just hope the horse hasn't bolted, because I was looking back over some of the material around the old Australia card debate. When was that? 90s? 80s, maybe? I can't remember. And some of the same folk are involved now, and you think, well, you know, that wasn't entirely that well informed. There was an element of fear there that doesn't, that isn't a great forerunner for good policy.
No, and what we certainly don't want to happen is that the good policy is the last point in the process. Because you have to be able to do all the risk assessment beforehand, before you commence these kinds of exercises, to make sure that you are driven primarily from protecting the interests of the individuals rather than looking at what's going to make it easier for whether it's health professionals or government. And of course we often don't do it that way, do we? Once people lose confidence in these kinds of new developments, it's very hard to get it back. And so we do see the public policy benefits of going down this path, but it's got to be watertight.
That's good. Cassandra, I always appreciate your opinion. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you too.
Well, Cassandra Goldie from the Australian Council of Social Services, ACOS.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.